From the New York Times article, The Psychedelic Revolution is Coming, Psychiatry May Never Be the Same, May 2021, Andrew Jacobs writes, quote, though researchers are still trying to understand the cognitive and therapeutic mechanics of psychedelics, they have concluded that psilocybin, DMT, and other psychoactive chemicals can help people feel more tolerance, understanding, and empathy. They also induce neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change and recognize thought patterns, enabling people with psychological disorders to find new ways to process anxiety, depression, or deeply embedded trauma. In November 2020, Oregonians voted on and passed two related measures, Measure 110, drug decriminalization and addiction treatment, and Measure 109, allowing the manufacture, delivery, and administration of psilocybin at supervised licensed facilities. It would have an imposed two-year development period. Measure 110 is the first of its kind and a potential model for the country. Jan, your book, Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, Breaking Down, was published last year in July 2020, and it provides, quote, a new way of thinking about PTSD and a good alternative to both critics and defenders of the diagnosis. It is the section of your book, Good Drugs, Bad Drugs, that we're interested in this morning as it connects to the passage of Measure 109 and the use of psychoactive drugs for treating mental health issues. You have called PTSD the poster child for treatment, but you point out that the use of psilocybin and other related psychoactive chemicals has been tested more widely. And I want to say about you, Jan, along with being an old mole lifer, you are a clinical psychologist, documentary filmmaker, and professor emeritus of community and clinical psychology in the Department of Psychology at Portland State University. And your 2014 documentary film, Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines, is a good companion piece for this subject, as the film offers, I quote, a rare glimpse of heated debates within the field of psychology over diagnosis and treatment of combat conditions and the limits of categories such as post-traumatic stress disorder in capturing the psychological impacts of warfare. So Jan, again, in your book, you offer a critique of the field of psychiatry, and you argue that PTSD is a symptom of dilemmas in the field of psychiatry itself. You also take up a new campaign for the use of psychedelics in the treatment of PTSD. So from your perspective, is the passage of Measure 109 a step forward? And do you agree with Andrew Jacobs with this psychedelic revolution that psychiatry will never be the same?
Well, I'll start with the most immediate question, the second one, playing on Michael Pollan's book, Changing Your Mind, I think it was called, whether this psychedelic movement, therapeutic use of psychedelics, changes the minds of psychiatry as a field remains to be seen. The campaign that drove a lot of the research nationally was organized through a group called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, and they've been steadily moving forward to convince the FDA to allow, for research purposes, the use of psychedelics in the treatment of mental health conditions. I describe PTSD as a poster condition because even though psychedelics are now used and there are therapeutic claims here in Oregon that it's helpful for depression, anxiety, addiction, and anxiety around death and dying, that PTSD was the one diagnosis that emerged that called for the responsibility of institutions, including the mental health field, to respond to socially produced suffering, suffering for which the person themselves is not directly implicated in causing. So there's a whole history of how PTSD called for something different in the field of psychiatry than other diagnoses and was a more difficult to manage politically because PTSD from the start was a political category and calling for acknowledgement of societal responsibility and mental suffering. But I think with the passage of 109, which kind of surprised me, it passed with a strong majority support, even though the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Psychiatric Association opposed the measure, and many of the established media, the Oregonian, opposed it. And yet it passed. And I think it expresses one of the dilemmas in psychiatry, that so many of the drugs administered by the medical profession are either ineffective for many people or have enormous side effects associated with them. It is a challenge to the field of psychiatry and medicine in that a lot of the organizing for this was not within the professions. It was, you know, even the process of approval and certification of practitioners does not require that the practitioners be licensed professionals. So there's a struggle that will unfold and is unfolding already with the advisory board formed through this passage of the ballot measure that will lay out guidelines for practitioners. There'll be an interesting fight over that. I think anything we do that decriminalizes drugs, and it's interesting to note, it's important to note that a lot of the street drugs start as medically prescribed drugs. You know, the opiate epidemic, as some people are calling it, is an effect of the overprescribing of drugs. So this boundary between a good drug and bad drug, you know, the medical profession is often the adjudicator of that border. And I think some of what people are experiencing now is how many of the drugs that are destructive in communities start out, you know, on the prescription path of a doctor. So I think there is a kind of crisis psychiatry in the medical profession is facing. It's been a long time since there were any psychoactive drugs that really moved things along in terms of symptoms of people suffering mental health conditions or what are called mental illness, forms of mental illness. I think this does challenge the profession and the paradigm, but I think more interesting or important than even the struggle over professional control over the management of emotional suffering is the way in which the settings of administered treatment are also challenged, that psychedelics really have fundamental difference from other psychiatric drugs because they are administered in a setting where the setting is important to acknowledge, traditionally under the guidance of a local shaman or medicine person who's undergone training and apprenticeship, including in taking the drug. They are taken for purposes of deep self-understanding. So in many ways, it's a revival of the human potential movement of the 60s and 70s that was very critical of the use of diagnoses and was before an era where to see a therapist, you had to have a DSM diagnosis or a mental disorder attached to the insurance claim. It is a challenge to the paradigm in many ways, but the way in which critiques of commercial practices or dominant practices become reincorporated into the dominant models is also something to consider here. I mean, pharmaceutical companies are lining up to cash in on the pharmaceutical so-called revolution. There are a lot of potentials for profit making that many people in the psychedelic field are very aware of.
I want to get back to that, but you mentioned who the folks were who did not support 110 and 109, and maybe more particularly 109, which had a lower percentage of votes than 110. 110 provides for funds for treatment, and that seems probably appealing to people versus creating more opportunities for what folks might think is drug use. But there were supporters involved in that campaign that probably will still be involved in the development process who have a completely different perspective on this and are more outside that kind of traditional psychiatric world.
Yeah. I think both of these measures clearly are related to decriminalization of drugs, and anything we can do to decriminalizing drugs is a step forward, and that must be said. I mean, possession of small amounts of drugs, and historically marijuana, are the gateway arrests into the criminal justice system. And mm-hmm. so many young people end up incarcerated because of possession of mm-hmm. small amounts of drugs. But I think it's important not to be too exuberant in the same way the deinstitutionalization movement of the 60s was very enamored with the idea of tearing down institutions and liberating people from constraints, literally, who had serious forms of psychosis. And then, you know, you can have people wandering the streets without much support. So mm-hmm. also it is part of this 109 as well. There's quite an emphasis in the description of the ballot measure that youth will not be able to use it, that you will not be able to access it recreationally, that it will only be administered by trained mental health practitioners of an unspecified background, but you have to be 21 years old or older. It also conforms to a national trend, reduces psychedelics as a priority of law enforcement. You know, Washington, D.C. decriminalized last year possession of psychedelics, so that nationally reduces a priority. The war on drugs of the 70s was really a war on the counterculture movement, the social movements and forms of protest that became associated with these drugs during the 60s and 70s. So in 1971, when psychedelics joined, it's called Schedule I by the Federal Drug Administration, that means they're the most dangerous and most addictive, even though it had been well established that psychedelics were not addictive. They're among the least addictive drugs. But yet they ended up in this category of the most dangerous and addictive. So this historical association between psychedelics and social movements is an interesting part of this, and how that will emerge now in the context of the social movements of our era is kind of an interesting part of this. There is a lot of discussion nationally by BIPOC practitioners on the theme of decolonizing psychedelic use, organizing against forms of appropriation, and we can talk a bit about what that might mean as well in terms of what it means to appropriate. This is a fun fact. Oregon has apparently the largest fungus known in the world.
Yes, the environment in Oregon would be very conducive for mushrooms. With our moisture and what's left of our old growth stands of trees, and, you know, depending on the mushroom.
And then big and small. I mean, the largest organism in the world, a 2.4-mile wide honey fungus, lives in Oregon. Can you believe it?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a great place for mushrooms and fungi. And, you know, Oregon has historically been a leader in decriminalizing drugs. It was the first state to decriminalize marijuana back in 1973. And like many Western states, laws can also be passed with a simple majority. There was also the history of appropriation of indigenous practices. You know, psychedelics have been used for millennia by indigenous peoples around the world and who've developed practices around their use. And a forward-looking aspect of this bill, that there's several years of discussion and coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement, addressing how access to mental health services, access to care through this availability of this service is going to benefit BIPOC communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of my concerns as well. I think of it in terms of how could capitalism and for-profit healthcare really ruin all of this quite easily. It's not just that Big Pharma has been adversarial towards alternative medicines, but also the war on drugs, as we talked about earlier, has been tremendously profitable. that sets up a bit of a conflict between policing and what kinds of funds come in for policing versus the drive for pharmaceutical companies to capture and control these substances, make them perhaps even private property. Somehow they'll figure out how to ruin it. Folks with less access won't be able to go into a designer clinic to have their trip.
Yeah, and I think this could be a site of struggle if there's not too much evangelism attached to it. I mean, I'm always wary of campaigns that promise so much. And in many ways, to fight any kind of politics that have been marginalized or demonized in the margins, you have to really push hard and believe in what you're doing. Mm. And, you know, there are two therapists, Tom and Sherry Eckert, here in Portland that pushed this ballot measure. It had a lot of money behind it from the Dr. Bronner soap company. Interesting history.
Yeah.
But, you know, the American Medical Association, the Oregon Medical Association and its allies, it's a steep hill. And I think the fact that this passed and it has opened space for critiques of the medical model, you know, I've written about from a critical psychology perspective, problems with psychiatry and diagnoses for a very long time. But this opens it up in a way that it's not only anti-psychiatry or anti the medical model, but it, I think, opening up space for thinking about not just controlling bothersome symptoms, but being more open to disturbing states or disturbing exceptional states and respecting them, exceptional states of mind, thinking about altered states of consciousness as something not to penalize or medicalize, but that humans have always experimented with alternative or exceptional states of mind, but Indigenous people have developed practices that have been in many places destroyed by colonialism, but still survive, that are respectful of these states and bring them into a community that kind of holds people during an exploratory state. Mm-hmm. You know, the field of psychiatry has never promoted the use of drugs for anything other than symptoms of a disorder, you know, to reduce the noise in the machine and not amplify it to hear it better.
Right, right, yes. Jan, in concluding, you talk a bit in your book about Timothy Leary and his work with psilocybin in particular, but broad personal research into psychedelics. And he was involved in using psychedelics or psilocybin in the prisons. In closing, could you say something brief about that, because that does exemplify these questions around knowledge of use and the importance of settings.
Yeah, the ghost of Timothy Leary has haunted the psychedelic movement for a long time, especially as it tries to fight for enlightenment in the field of medicine and psychiatry. And I think he's been to some extent demonized as the embodiment of what people see as the excesses of the psychedelic side of the 60s and 70s, and his own maniacal charisma. But an earlier phase of his work, I think, has been left behind. It's little known, that influenced me actually early on teaching in the area of psychopathology, where early on in his career, before he got fired at Harvard in the early 60s, he administered psilocybin in prisons outside of Boston. And the conditions involve prisoners over time learning about the experience and then being trained as guides for other prisoners. Prisoners could set their own goals for self-development and coming to terms with their histories. And when you read the studies, the difference between those settings and what you can imagine in a prison today in this country, it's startling. I mean, he oversold his findings, but that often happens. But on the basis of that work, he developed this approach to drug effects called set and settings. And, of course, anyone who uses psychedelic drugs knows that the setting is very important. And He said, if you give someone a pill and send them on their way, you're not really creating a setting that allows them to use this altered state in a way that can open new insights. Mm-hmm. So what is now a kind of common idea and has been psychedelic culture was a profound new insight at the time, and it still is not an idea that's incorporated into psychiatry, that people who are taking a drug that affect their minds can benefit from a setting that helps them learn from that experience, and it's a social setting. And then the idea of set, he was saying a lot of the effects people have of drugs, including psychedelics, have to do with the attitude of the practitioner. If you think this drug is going to be bad for a person, or you're afraid of it, or you haven't experienced it yourself, then you are conveying something to the patient or the individual taking the drug. And he also emphasized the way in which practitioners and his own students were encouraged, of course, to take psilocybin, because you have to know something about this experience to be receptive to it and teach someone else. And a lot of the bad trips people had early on in what was called the LSD movement were the effect of not having a culture to support the use of the drug, how to develop practices around it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to that extent, the psychedelic movement, if you want to call it that, is a profound challenge to psychiatry and an important one.
Right. Dan, this has been really great and timely as we move into this psychedelic revolution.
Not sure I'd call it a revolution, but yeah, we're turning on and tuning into it.
Right. Oh, good one. Yeah. Your book, again, is Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD Breaking Down, and that came out last year, July 2020, and I'll recommend that to folks. We'll post
Great.
Links to that in the article in New York Times, The Psychedelic Revolution is Coming, Psychiatry May Never Be the Same, by Andrew Jacobs. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
We are the hallucination. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the hallucination. Our DNA is of earth and sky.